Iranians living in Florida respond to the rising tensions between the U.S. and their home nation. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The president recently spoke about the increased tensions between the two nations. He once again reiterated that the attack on Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was justified and the U.S. is ready to defend itself. But what does an escalation of violence between nations mean for Iranians living here in South Florida? Also, it's National Young Arts Week. We'll meet Santino Fontana and talk with him about teaching the next generation of actors. Finally, the legislative session is a week away. Two key issues for this session: how much should teachers be paid in the Sunshine State, and should we end tolling on major thoroughfares? State Senator Manny Diaz Jr. joins us. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Iran fulfilled its promise to retaliate after a U.S. airstrike killed Iranian top general Qasem Soleimani. Iranian missiles struck bases housing U.S. forces in Iraq yesterday, and this comes after Iranian leaders vowed revenge against the U.S. But how are Iranians living in the U.S. responding to these rising tensions? Eric Loeb is an assistant professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Florida International University. He's an expert on the intersection of development and politics in the Middle East, and we spoke to him earlier today.
There is an Iranian-American population here, and they're limited in numbers, but they're high in influence. They do have an influence on the local economy and business and different areas of society, philanthropy, healthcare. So they represent, while not large in numbers, an important presence here, a significant presence, but definitely much lower numbers compared to, for example, in Los Angeles or New York.
Right. And what about the diaspora, just for folks from the Middle East? What kind of population are we talking about? What are we hearing from them about everything that's happened over the past week, especially about the death of General Soleimani?
People are definitely on edge, and there's obviously the community here has a diversity of opinions, and it also depends on when they came from Iran in the Middle East. People who tend to have left or tend to have come to the United States closer to 1979 during the Iranian Revolution tend to be more anti-government compared to the people who came after, although, of course, there's a diversity of opinions there, too. Some are pro-government, Iranian government I'm talking about. Some are anti. But regardless, across the spectrum, with people I've talked to, people are on edge at the prospects of escalating tensions, culminating, of course, with the assassination of General Soleimani, the missile strikes yesterday against U.S. bases. People thinking, is there going to be an end to this? Is there an exit strategy? Do both sides have an exit strategy? Is there an off-ramp?
What I'm hearing from you is the older Iranian Americans have a very different perspective on these relationships, this relationship between our two nations, compared to the younger Iranians, right?
There's generational differences. There's been different ways of immigration. I'm not going to say that more recent or younger Iranian Americans are pro-regime necessarily or pro-Iranian government, but they're a little more removed from, although there have been, of course, contentious events there involving the younger generation. But, and I think we see this in other diaspora communities too, they tend to see these things perhaps from a less visceral, emotional state, although again, I'm not going to generalize. But across the board, generationally, there are concerns. But there are, of course, Iranians that are seeing this as potentially an opportunity for regime change and a new government, and that are, some are supporting these actions, these military actions.
The relationship between the U.S. and Iran has been contentious for decades. But what is that relationship like compared to the relationship we have with other countries in that region? Iran is very different than many of the countries in that region.
Absolutely. It's a very dynamic country. It has, from the outside in the West or in the United States, we tend to see it as one man, the supreme leader in control of everything. But it's a very dynamic country where you have elites representing different points of view, even media representing different points of view. Even though the government sets the rules of the game, you do have, to an extent, open elections every, like we do here, every 4 years for parliament, for president. So I've spent a lot of time traveling in the region, both in the Arab world and Iran. And there's definitely a level of dynamism there that you don't necessarily see in the Arab world. And it creates possibilities there. If I were to say one country that in the future could reform politically, could democratize, if that's a direction that people want the country to take, I would say there's a greater potential there, for example, than in other parts of the region where it tends to be one man, one rule, or so one party.
You talk about these tensions, and what's the difference when you say, you know, the United States kills General Soleimani? What's different from saying when the United States killed Osama bin Laden?
Yes, there's a tremendous difference there. With Osama bin Laden, even with the recent death or strike and killing of Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, these are viewed as non-state actors, although ISIS was trying to create a state between Iraq and Syria, but non-state actors where there's a consensus that they're terrorist organizations, or at the very least have extremist ideologies, where with Iran, they have clear political strategic goals. They don't always align with the United States. Very clearly, for example, with Iranian supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon, supporting the Assad regime in Syria, even making things uncomfortable for the United States and Iraq, there's times where those interests didn't align. But nonetheless, they are an established state, and Soleimani was a senior military and political official, not just part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, not just building partnerships with militias or even supporting militias around the region, but even brokering deals with politicians around the region as well. And there's a blurry line, too, because a lot of these militias that Iran helped create and support have found their way into their local governments.
I'm talking with Eric Loeb, assistant professor at the Department of Politics and International Relations at Florida International University. He's an expert on the intersection of development and politics in the Middle East. President Trump recently addressed the nation about the missile attacks on two bases in Iraq housing U.S. troops. We hear in those speeches during the ceremonies where they were taking Soleimani's body through Tehran, again, revenge. We're going to get revenge, God's revenge on the United States. What does that mean? Is it the attacks, the missile attacks on the U.S. bases, or would Iran go as far as attacking the U.S. on our soil, on the continental United States?
It's not something that could be ruled out because Iran, the Revolutionary Guard and other agencies in Iran, they have assets all around the world. And they have either conducted or attempted to conduct attacks on U.S. soil and around the world. They haven't just confined it to the Middle East. But I think something that's important, I mean, the rhetoric has been dialed up very high. The Iranians obviously want to save face here and preserve their legitimacy. Soleimani was a national hero for defending Iranian national interests, for fighting against groups like ISIS, which is equally an enemy to the Islamic Republic of Iran as it is to the United States. And his operations were predominantly outside the country, so they weren't inside against protesters and activists, unlike other branches of the Revolutionary Guard. So he became a national hero. And Iranian politicians have all vowed revenge for his assassination. But one point that I'd like to make is that, and we saw it again yesterday with the strikes on the two U.S. military bases, is that Iran, since the United States have withdrawn from the nuclear deal in May 2018, Iran has increased the pressure on the United States and its allies, avoiding casualties or minimizing casualties, let's say, as they did yesterday, to avoid a direct confrontation with the United States. The Iranians are aware that they're conventionally inferior to the United States. Their top priority is to survive as a government, as a regime. And so they're taking steps, again, to increase the cost, to inflict pain on the U.S. and allies, but at the same time avoiding a direct confrontation with the United States.
So it's not, per se, like, say, they have to have an attack that is equivalent. It's not an eye for an eye. You took out our general. You have to take out somebody of importance. It's not something like that.
I can't unequivocally say what the Iranians may do next. But with this attack yesterday, I could speak to yesterday's attack and even what they've done since May 2018, hitting oil tankers, trying to drive up the price of oil, hitting Saudi Arabia oil fields and oil refineries, taking down, as the president acknowledged today, two unmanned U.S. drones. And it wasn't even a direct Iranian attack. I'm not justifying what was done. It was actually their backed Shia militias in Iraq that killed an American contractor and wounded U.S. troops. And again, we saw with the attacks yesterday that Iran is avoiding at all costs American casualties because they sense, I'm not sure if it's been communicated to them because we've had very weak diplomatic channels since we've pulled out of the nuclear deal, but again, to sensing that American casualties, as has been communicating with the death of his contractor, is a red line for the United States.
Because, you know, one of the things this is kind of reminds me of is sort of after 9/11, there was this tension. And of course, security gets beefed up everywhere. This fear of an attack here. We have the Super Bowl coming up. It's a big event. So I'd imagine tension's going to be there with law enforcement, security, just because it's one of our biggest events for us that represents so much for Americans.
Sure. And there will be a high security presence. And you've already seen it. And as a matter of fact, yesterday or 2 days ago, there were reports of ICE or Department of Homeland Security detaining Iranian Americans at the U.S.-Canadian border in the Northwest. So this is what makes, again, whether Iranian Americans or pro-government Iranian government or anti-regime, anti-Iranian government, they're all on edge because these escalations directly impact them. And regardless of their citizenship status, regardless of their visa status, they were detained at the U.S. border by these officials.
Do you have students from Iran?
Yes, we do. We have, fortunately, we actually have students both at the undergraduate level, but also at the graduate and masters and PhDs coming from Iran, coming from the Middle East. We're hoping to maintain these academic contacts and connections and bridges. But of course, in the current geopolitical environment, this is very difficult to do, and we're seeing lower numbers.
I wonder if they talk to you about their fears and concerns as this escalates, as you said, because, you know, could there be kind of a retaliation just in how people here in this country act or react towards them because of who they are?
Yes, absolutely. And we saw this with 9/11, even with President George W. Bush saying that this is not the war against the U.S. war against terrorism in reaction to 9/11 is not a war against Islam. We still saw social stigmatization and even at the very worst, hate crimes and violence against Muslim communities. And again, and Americans don't always differentiate, right, between a Muslim who's from Iran or a Muslim who's from the Middle East or even other parts of the Muslim world outside of the Middle East. So these communities in general are very much on edge. And even before the increase in escalations, we already had in 2017 the travel ban on Iranians and on citizens of different Muslim countries from coming to the U.S. So the environment was already there even before things really amped up and the escalations really increased for, you know, creating an environment to put people on edge from these countries and fearing that they may not be able to go back and visit their families and separating families, really.
You know, both President Obama and President Bush had the opportunities to kill Soleimani, and they chose not to. How did the military strategy differ under this presidency that ultimately led to the strike? What was different now compared to those two administrations?
People at the very highest levels are asking themselves this question. First of all, what is our strategy in Iran, in the Middle East? This was definitely a tactical strike, but what larger strategy is this a part of? What is the timing? Why now? Was he hit? There's reports that he was actually flying on a commercial airliner from either Lebanon or Syria to Iraq to meet with the Iraqi prime minister to talk about mitigating tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia, that he was traveling on an official diplomatic passport to do this. And again, I'm not justifying his past actions. As you said, there's been past opportunities or at least desires to eliminate him. But I think the previous administrations wanted to avoid a direct conflict in Iran. And also, when this puts us in a weaker position now in Iraq, because it's put us in a defensive posture, as opposed to being on the offensive against groups like ISIS. So there's a lot of strategic disadvantages to this move and blowback.
Yeah, I mean, there's still talk about whether Iraq wants the U.S. to get out.
Right.
But how does this play out for the U.S. in Syria, in Israel, in the Middle East in general.
Right. So here we are with a president who campaigned on withdrawing from the Middle East or reducing our footprint there and pivoting, as we've heard before, to more important or higher priority geostrategic and geopolitical goals, i.e. China, Asia. And yet here we see that even he couldn't avoid this, that he, and again, I see this as a crisis that was largely generated by the U.S. because the U.S. actually made the decision to withdraw from the nuclear deal, to increase economic sanctions on Iran, to designate the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is part of the Iranian military, a terrorist organization. So it's taken measures since President Trump came into office, and particularly since May 2018, to escalate and increase tensions with Iran. So how can you expect as an administration, as a government, for us to withdraw our presence from the Middle East, Iran, and then while at the same time escalating tensions with a regional power?
So this comes back to something you said a second ago, just trying to figure out what is the long-term strategy for Iran right now under this president.
Well, that's the problem, and I think a lot of people are asking themselves the question. I would say the closest thing we have to a strategy is maximum pressure on Iran, and that really translates to regime change. This government seems to think that with applying maximum economic pressure on Iran, but again, unilaterally, we've also alienated a lot of our allies in the process who were part of the nuclear deal and want to see it maintained, even though the Europeans have wavered on it. That's the big question is, you know, is maximum pressure, is regime change, even though the Trump administration and his cabinet members are reticent to use that language, is that something that's even achievable? Is that something that's even realistic when Iran has already been facing, perhaps not as intense as now, but has already faced sanctions and embargoes for the last four decades and managed to weather it?
Professor Loeb, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, that's Eric Loeb, assistant professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Florida International University. Well, still to come, one of the voices from Frozen and a performer on the TV series Crazy Ex-Girlfriend joins us to discuss the National Young Arts Award. That's next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, some of the top musicians, artists, and actors from around the globe are here in Miami for National Young Arts Week. It's an opportunity for high school students to learn from some of the leading artists and meet some of their peers with similar career ambitions. Santino Fontana recently won a Tony for his role in the Broadway musical Tootsie. You may know him from his role as Prince Hans in the Disney hit Frozen and as Greg in the series Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Fontana's a master teacher this year. He was a 2000 Young Arts winner and a participant himself, and he joins us now. Santino, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
You know, you grew up in a small city in Central California, and you spent your formative years in rural Washington. Well, you know, it's an interesting place to start. But when did you become interested in the arts, in theater, in television, in acting?
As a child, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and they didn't, I don't think they knew what to do. So they took us to Blockbuster, which people who remember what that was, and they would just pick the movies that they loved. And it was a wide range of movies. And then we would go home and we would watch them on repeat. And I think that was the first time I kind of became enamored and kind of in awe of the power of story and how it can bring people together and it can teach us about humanity and ourselves and entertain us and move us and get us to think. And I was hooked. Yeah.
Did you remember, though, the first time you ever said, well, I want to do that for a living?
You know, I don't think... It was one of those things, I think, it's like a dream that you don't let be spoken for a long time. But Young Arts, coming to Young Arts, that which is now 20 years ago, which makes me want to, oh God, it's so terrifying.
Talk about age, it's okay.
It's but 20 years ago, coming here, that was one of the first times where it felt like, oh, well, this is possible. This is a real option as a pursuit for me to go after this.
And when you were young, I mean, how did you hear about the Young Arts program?
You know, my principal Her name was Joan Huey. She back in Washington State, she handed me a packet, which was about young arts. And I don't think anyone from my high school or even the area of where I'm from had ever applied. And she was like, this might be something that you should do. And I did back then, you know, you make a tape and you put monologues and songs on it and you send it away and hope someone's going to look at it. And that was it. This is before the internet. This is before young arts had the stature that it has now. It was still highly respected, but not as well known as it is now. Yeah, that was it.
What was the process for getting admitted? I wonder if it's changed, but what was it like for you?
I had my parents leave their bedroom. I got a VHS camcorder. I set it up. I did a monologue from Death of a Salesman and a David Ives monologue. And I then begged the choir teacher at the high school to use the choir room where I sang Something's Coming from West Side Story, put it on a tape, sent it in. That was it. That was the process. And then there were three panelists. Kenneth Washington, who has since passed away, Anthony Rapp, who's an actor who many people know. He was in Rent. He's also on that Star Trek show now. And Kimberly Scott, a fantastic Tony-nominated actress who's also been on tons of television and film and is a theater actress as well. They were our judges, our panelists, who watched the tapes and invited 20 of us back in 2000 to come to Miami.
The program itself, how do you describe what that week-long program is like, the kind of things that you get to do and the experiences you have?
It's life-changing. It's life-changing, and I cannot separate that week from my current life. They are directly linked. My life changed when I was brought here. I was given a vote of confidence of saying, we see something in you, continue. And in the process, I ended up going to college because of somebody I met here. The college I chose was led by somebody I met at Arts Week. I had classmates who were at Arts Week who came and studied with me in college. I think about it all the time. I mean, there's nothing, artists will understand, to be chosen and given that support at that stage in your life is so vital and so important.
I wonder about the advice that you get. I mean, at that age, you're young, impressionable, and you've got all this ambition, but you don't know how tough the world could be.
Mm-hmm.
But what kind of advice did they give you? And I wonder if any of it was at least a little bit realistic, like, okay, chase your dreams, but it's going to be tough.
Absolutely. I mean, they definitely reminded us of that. It is, and it's the truth. However, what they focused on, which was so transformative, was the power of art and that will not change. The business is a separate thing, but the power of stepping into somebody else's shoes and telling their story in an effort for us to better understand ourselves and one another, that's not going anywhere. And that will feed you for your entire life. And that's what we focused on this week, both in terms of transformation, in terms of skills and being able to bring a character to life, honoring what an author is trying to intend. All of those things were like the bedrock of an artist's life were what were drilled into us, which is what is really going to get you through when you feel like, God, I can't get, no one's hiring me. No one wants me for this audition, or I can't get seen. This business is so hard. All of which is still going to be true. The thing that will remind you of what's important is what they taught us, what they reminded us of this week. And that we need stories about each other to bring us together and to get us through.
I'm talking with actor Santino Fontana. You know him from roles in Disney's film Frozen, from the TV series Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. He was a National Young Arts finalist back in the 2000s, 20 years ago, as he likes to tell us. He is back in Miami this week. He's a master teacher, so he's working with this new group, this new crop of finalists, and getting them ready for their careers. By the way, there are a number of performances happening this week, and you can find out more about it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, from that experience, I mean, is that what led you to, because you went to theater at the University of Minnesota. Now, I'm the first to say I didn't know. Is that a good place for it? Because you tend to think of theater like you're either going to New York or L.A., right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the Guthrie Theater is a great regional theater in Minneapolis. It was founded in 1963. Hume Cronyn, Jessica Tandy, great actors started out there. And also, it's still a thriving theater community. Ken Washington, who was one of the panelists, was starting a new actor training program there, classical training program, to teach students to be able to tell the classics of the past as well as the future. And I knew I wanted a career and a life in the art and not in the arts, and not just to be a flash in the pan or to get success briefly and not really know what to do with it. So, I wasn't in any rush to go to LA or New York. And, you know, the majority of actors who working actors, are not in New York or LA. They're throughout the country. So it's a misconception, but it's also understandable. And then I moved to New York in 2006 after my time in Minneapolis.
And you look at your career, I mean, stage, film, television, you know, you've worked on so many roles. You Prince Charming in the Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella, against Prince Hans in Frozen, the bartender in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Do you, first of all, do you have a preference? Is there one medium you like more than any other?
I love it all.
Okay. All right.
I really do. I mean, answer. I think you're never going to get the same immediacy of theater. I mean, I just finished Tootsie last week, and there's nothing like that. There's nothing like leading an audience through a story with a group of actors and editing as you go, and responding to how they're reacting. There's nothing better, and there's nothing like that. TV and film is exciting because you're really giving options. You're not making decisions that are the final decisions of what scene, what cuts are going to be in the movie or the TV show. So you're there as a generator of ideas. It's just a different muscle.
When you're talking to young people, giving them advice, I mean, do you say, you know, is there one area that's better to start, get into theater or get into film or television, or does it matter?
I think you've got to do what feeds you. You've got to go after what feeds you, and you have to figure that out. And this is the time when they're going to start kind of wrestling with that, and looking at it in a more serious way. If I like, you know, telling the stories of people whose stories need to be told, and in a wide range of genres, as many I can possibly think of. I say I've been avoiding my identity my whole life. That's why I'm an actor. I want to be able to pretend to be other people so I can maybe learn more about what it's like to be other people. And then whatever form or whatever medium that's in, you know, so be it.
I also wonder, too, and I mean, again, going back to this idea of talking to young people about what their future could entail, is the fact that all of those mediums are so different. So when you're acting on stage, it's a lot of rehearsal so that when you're live, you're on spot. But mm-hmm. when you're doing television and film, as you know, is that it's a lot of start, stop. But I don't know. What do you tell young people about the differences in how you approach each one of those?
Just that it's going to take time. It's going to take time for you to learn all of the things required of each. You know, I had a great teacher who would say every job as an actor, the first job is figuring out what playground you're on and what are the rules before you can start really diving in. I mean, television or a movie, rehearsal is very, very limited typically. So you're really being hired to make the decisions about the character. Whereas in rehearsal for a play, you would have a month of like, I'm going to try it this way and I want to try it this way. And we're going to talk about that with the director. Television and film is not typically that way. That's what you're being brought to the set to do, to make those decisions, which is also freeing and exciting in its own way.
From a consumer standpoint, you know, you look at the world today. I mean, you have film, but, you know, television just used to be a few companies. Now mm-hmm. it's all these streaming companies. Everybody's getting in the business of creating content. So great for the consumer. For an actor, is that a good thing?
Oh, yes. Oh, God, yes. I mean, Louis, there's a new show on Netflix every day. You know what I mean? Like, it's overwhelming. I mean, I can't watch everything. I feel guilty for not seeing everything. But the access to being able to get people to watch your work is so much greater. And the great thing is now all these kids, all these students that I'm about to go teach, they have a movie camera on their phone.
Yes.
You know, if I had that, you know.
Well, you wouldn't have needed the VHS.
I sure wouldn't have. or the postage. I think it's a great time to be able to communicate with large groups of people because everything is so, there's so much out there.
You know what? At some point, please show them what a VHS is so they could, because I grew up in Blockbuster. I loved it. You're talking to these young people, and again, they have this great ambition and all of these dreams for the future. But I want to know, what's the best advice that you got when you were a student? What's the advice you're giving them?
The advice I'm going to give them, I think, is really going to be twofold. It's both, like, this week was kind of a beginning of, if you choose to do this, here's your welcome. And we're telling you, you've got what it takes to do it if you want to really do this. But also that ultimately they have to listen to themselves. That the only thing that's going to get them through is what feeds them in the doing of it. If it feeds you to be working on a monologue or working on a scene or trying to get into the headspace and the body of a character and to breathe life into a writer's words and tell that story to an audience, then you've got to listen to that because that's not going to go away.
Santino Fontana, he was a National Young Arts finalist 20 years ago. He's back in Miami this week. He's a master teacher now teaching the next group of young artists. And again, a number of performances happening this week. You could find it on our social media at WLRN Suntile. Santino, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, still to come, the governor has a plan to raise teacher salaries, but it's facing controversy. We're going to speak with State Senator Manny Diaz Jr. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, do you know how much your local school teachers get paid? In Miami, Broward, and Palm Beach, the base pay is around $41,000. In Monroe, it's a little higher. It's about $47,000. Last year, Governor Ron DeSantis made a proposal to raise teacher salaries across the state of Florida to a base pay of $47,500. Republican State Senator Manny Diaz Jr. sponsoring a bill to make that teacher pay raise a reality, and he joins us now to discuss that, toll roads, and, well, the legislative session's about to start in a week, so we're going to talk as much as we can about that. Senator Diaz, great to have you.
Pleasure being with you here, and
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
All right, let's jump right into this one. This is the big one. The governor wanted the teacher pay raise. This is a big part of his, a big project for him this year. You've got Senate Bill 1088. Again, it raises the minimum salary for public school teachers to $47,500. Why do you support that minimum salary?
Well, I think, first of all, the governor has launched a proposal, which many people have been clamoring for years here in Florida. And really, it's an issue that's being talked about nationally. So this bill really gives the opportunity for the governor's proposal to be discussed in the Senate and also leaves some leeway for what a lot of us understand, which is, it sounds great to bring everybody up to $47,500, but you just mentioned what salaries are in South Florida counties. And if you look at the comparison to other counties in the state, some of those other counties would receive a much higher influx of cash to raise those salaries to that level, while down here we have a cost of living issue. So my bill really leaves it a little more open to have a discussion of how do you get folks to $47,500, and yet allowing those counties who have been working towards that number or close to that number to be rewarded in more flexibility.
Look, a lot of this, right, is about trying to get that minimum salary in Florida so we move up, you know, nationally. We're not that high because we want to recruit better teachers. We want to get more teachers here, right?
That's absolutely correct. There's also some more background on that. Some of it can be deceptive because you have a lot of rural counties in Florida where the cost of living is much lower. And so it's comparing apples and oranges. If you say to somebody that they're in you know, Calhoun County and they're making 47.5, that's
very
a
different
huge salary. Yeah.
Okay. That's one of the criticisms. I want to get to that. But one of the other criticisms about this is great for new teachers, young teachers, veteran teachers, not so happy with this. What have you been hearing?
Well, yeah, and that's the governor's proposal, which initially only talked about the 47.5. That's why in my proposal in 1088, you see the flexibility for that when districts get close to that, to be able to use the rest of those funds to spread it across the veteran teachers. So the flexibility, at the end of the day in Florida, school boards dictate the salaries for teachers locally in each county, and it's collectively bargaining. So we only have so much control over that. This is an innovative way to try to put money, to force money into teachers' pockets, and at the same time say to districts, you have to invest this in teacher salaries.
What do you hear from teachers? What do they want? What are they saying to you about, especially, I mean, look, because this is South Florida, as you said, cost of living is very high. But what are they telling you? What have they been saying to you about what is necessary to keep them here and not leave for another state?
So for teachers, especially in South Florida, it's more about the respect of the profession, and there's not a magic number in the salary. You can't find a magic number to the salaries. It's more about a combination of proper salary, respect with their own professional development, more control over their professional development, more of a position of respect that traditionally has been the position that teachers have. I mean, when we grew up, that's how teachers were viewed.
Well, how do you do that? How do you accomplish that as a lawmaker? Is that up to you?
That's a tough haul, but I think that the combination of trying to deal with the salary and the compensation issue, trying to deal with the professional development. I mean, these are professionals, and they should have more control over what their professional development looked like. I also have another bill that does that, and too many of these professional development sessions are dictated either by the state or by the district. And what I'd like to see is, yeah, there's some things that are necessary, but I'd like to see teachers have more control over their group professional growth.
You know, again, the governor wants, you know, this program to raise teacher pay for the minimum pay. It's about a $600 million cost, I think, is about right for his. Where's the money coming from?
So believe it or not, there's a misconception in the state that we don't spend a lot on education. It was actually 38% of the general revenue budget that we control is already spent on K-12 education. So there are some places where you can shift some dollars around. There are categoricals within the funding formula. There's the education trust fund, which is funded by the lottery, where some things can be moved around. I mean, there is room. There's also already elimination of the best and brightest would already give us about $300 million.
The governor wants to end
with
that.
Correct.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I'm fine with ending. As long as, look, that these are all the attempts to get to the same place, which is to compensate teachers. If you're going to go down this road, a different route, then you have to get rid of that program so that you can take those dollars and implement them. Because if you continue to split them, then it doesn't make a real difference in any capacity.
And you talk about the lottery, and there was the piece in the Tampa Bay Times.
Right.
Somebody's asking, why do we take more money out of the lottery?
Yeah, I'm not opposed to that, and I think that's something we'll look at. But we've got to be very careful. Most people talk about that and say, where's the money for the lottery? Well, remember, a very popular program in Florida, Bright Futures, and that takes about $544 million a year from the lottery funds to fund that. And that's obviously our students that perform well being able – it's being spent on education, but it's not necessarily K-12. It's really the students that are leaving the K-12 system going on to the college system. So – There are some things when you start pulling these strings, it's like a ball of yarn. You got to be careful what you pull.
Is there any concern as we move into the future that, you know, tax revenue might drop and we can't maintain, you know, the expenditures that we want on education?
Well, the truth is that much less revenues could even out, but much less than revenues dropping, the bigger concern is that the certain costs in the state keep going up. Healthcare, the cost of us participating in federal programs, the state portion. People often think that these dollars come from the federal government with no strings. No, oftentimes there's a share has to be covered by the state. And at the end of the day, even though our FRS pension system is healthy according to national standards, it's still about 84% funded. The rest of that has to come from general funds. So there's obligations and costs that continue to grow every year. And so even when the economy is roaring and revenues are coming in, you see these economists make these projections where you have issues. And it's really a cost issue, not necessarily a revenue issue.
Education, always such a big debate here in the state of Florida for every session. For you, I want to get a sense of what you think our education system looks like And, you know, as a lawmaker, you can't fix everything, but what do you want to make better?
I think the teacher compensation, professional development, and continued a move towards an education system that's modernized, meaning looking at the 6-year window of a when a student enters ninth grade and 2 years after they're graduated from high school. And that means a compilation of giving them access to dual enrollment early so they can save money later on because they don't pay for those courses. And for those students that want to go into a certain trade, coding, whatever it is, to be able to have a 6-year continuing education without necessarily having to go to college and draw up some debt. So I think that we're moving in that direction. I also have legislation that talks about that. It's the PTEC bill. In allowing students to, we finally realized, look, there's students that are good with their hands. There's students that are better at other things, more technical. They need to be given the opportunity to do this without incurring all this debt.
We're talking with State Senator Manny Diaz Jr. of District 36. Legislative session starts January 14th. It starts early this year because it's an election year. Let's go from the classroom. Let's go to the highways. You've got Senate Bill 1090. This ends the express lanes on the Palmetto, the 826, ends tolls on the road as well. Why is this important to you?
Because the artery where these express lanes are located is directly in the heart of my district. And it's clearly well-intentioned, but it's clearly not working. It's causing congestion. And I think there's some flaws in the design that can be that may be able to be adapted to relieve those congestion, those choke points.
Do you want to get rid of the
but
express
I do,
lanes altogether?
My starting volley is that I want to get rid of altogether. If there is a solution that can be come up with that would work and still allow that, because I understand there are folks that are trying to get from both Broward and the northern part of the county down into the central and south part of the county, and the express lanes do work for that, but at the same time, not at the expense of those folks that are trying to get to work every day in
the
regular
lanes. If I'm not mistaken, you want to end the tolls on that road, right?
That's correct. And the only tolls on that road are in the express lane.
All right. I mean, FDOT collects millions, you know, on its tolls here in South Florida. Is there a fear we could lose out a lot of money, though?
You look at the one of the problems is that the tolls that are collected on that road are strictly to pay for the maintenance of those lanes because there's no bonding on it. The problem with that is there's not a lot of ridership. If you look at the cars that are going through the express lanes, it doesn't make any sense. It's a minimal amount that's charged and there's few cars going through there. So it begs the question, we're hampering the progress or the pathways for those that are using the regular lanes, and a lot of them not by choice because they can't even get on the express lane. That access is a problem. And so we need to go back to the drawing board where they expanded the Palmetto by one lane, but they took two lanes away for the express lane, and in some places three because of the onboarding ramp.
Look, this is your region, and I know that a lot of the, you know, we talk about transit issues. A lot of it is local, but, you know, I just want to get a sense from you. Is in South Florida, we depend so much on our car, so it's constant expansion. We're seeing the 836 now getting double-deckered. So, I mean, is it constant expansion of highways and thoroughfares, or should we be looking, should the state be pushing for other options?
So in South Florida, because we're such a large metropolitan county, really those decisions are going to fall on the locals because of the fact that
the state can't put a little pressure
The state can, but some of the problems that we incur here is we didn't have proper planning. So we grew, and none of the infrastructure was put in beforehand. What happens is it becomes so much more expensive after the fact. And part two is, and I think we've discussed this before, is that there's no culture of public transit, mass transit here. So people are used to their cars, and even when you give them those options, oftentimes they don't want to take them because they don't want to take two bus routes or take the bus and the train. How do we move our county, how do we move our community towards that and then provide those options is the bigger question, I think.
What do you think is the future of the Miami-Dade Expressway Authority, you know, this ongoing fight right now?
Well, I think the court's going to decide that. That's where it's sitting, at the appellate court. I think what happens is it gets overturned, the law gets in place, and you'll have the Greater Miami Expressway Authority. You'll have the locals sitting on there. You'll have more of the input from local mayors, from the municipalities, as well as the county and the three appointees by the governor. And hopefully they'll start to look at more futuristic, innovative measures to improve traffic, not just the expansion of ramps or the creation of new roads with new tolls. That's the problem that I think we've had.
Do you think Senate Bill 1090 has the support?
I do think Senate Bill 1090 has the support both in the House and the Senate. It always complicates matters when the really what happens with transit, the Florida Department of Transportation makes all those decisions administratively and through regional approval processes. So we got a limited window of time to put the pressure on this to get solved. And I think they're moving in the direction of trying to come up with a solution before we even pass the bill. So hopefully that's what we'll get to.
As I mentioned, the session starts on January 14th. It's early this year again because it's an election year, not just the presidential election. It's an election year. You've got members of the House and Senate here who are, you know, going to be running again. How does that change the dichotomy of a session when you know there's an election? You got people who are going to be stepping out of office or they're rerunning for office. Does that play a role?
So session is designed in Florida because of the limited time, 60 days, to really be crunch, and it creates a sense of urgency. Right, I think when you have early session in an election year, you have people terming out, which is this is their last shot at getting their, you know, whatever they came to Tallahassee to do, and number two, you have people that have re-election, so they want to get that part under their belt before they move on to the campaign. Fortunately for me, I'm not on the ballot this year, so I can go through a session as a regular session. But I think it creates a great sense of urgency amongst lawmakers, and that it creates more pressure. So it does become a tinderbox.
You know, it is a presidential election. Does the presidential election ever interfere in any way? Presidential politics just gets into everything, doesn't it?
It does, but I'll tell you, once you get inside that sphere of the 60-day session, it's really limited because they're Florida-based issues that are being tackled there. And if you spend any time away from those issues you're trying to tackle, the sands of time will go on you, and you'll realize it's the last week of session, and now your bills are dead. So I think a lot of that is overblown. I think more or less during session, there's really a laser focus on the things that need to get done.
I mean, one of the interesting things, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, the Florida primary, you're going to be very close in there. And when that Florida primary hits, I think session ends just before that, or
March 13th, I believe it is, if I'm not mistaken, that week.
So, you know, real quickly, I remember the last couple of years of Governor Rick Scott, there was a tension, even though Republicans were in charge, still are, of all the chambers, there was a tension between the governor and the House and Senate. But it seemed like the first year under DeSantis, not as much. What's it like right now between the chambers, between the governor? How do you see going into this session?
Well, I think you actually have great harmony. I mean, this is usually dictated by the presiding officers, right? And so I think the Speaker of the House, Jose Oliva, and the President of the Senate, Bill Galvano, have a great personal relationship. They vowed to work together, even though where they have differences, they have a way to work it out. And so we've seen a lot less drama, and it's just in their personalities, that we've seen in sessions before. With Governor DeSantis, he came in, I think, with a better understanding of the legislative process because he was a legislator, came from Congress, so he understands the role of the legislature and has respect for it. I think Governor Scott had a different, he was more of a CEO type. He came in from the business world and had that was kind of his style. So there was more clashes with the legislature, but you know, it is what it is, but I think Governor DeSantis respects the role of the legislature.
What do you think is going to be the bigger topics? What may be the most contentious topic of debate during this session?
So, look, I think one of the contentious topics is how much we're able to spend on teacher compensation, because I think everybody agrees we want to do something on teacher compensation, but how much money do you really have in the budget to be able to get to that point? I think that gaming is going to be an issue that is discussed, and we really are operating without a compact now, so the state can be losing anywhere between $300 million and $900 million, depends on who you ask, in gaming revenue. So I think that's going to be a pressing issue. Infrastructure and transportation is always a pressing issue, and where does that go? And do you start to see the beginnings of the formation of redistricting committees and things of that? I don't think we do. I think it's early for that, but that could always rear its head during this session.
And for you, because I mean, I know as we mentioned, you know, the teacher compensation, the toll roads, but what are a couple other big goals for you personally?
For me personally, those two are big goals. The third goal for me is really to modernize some of the way we our education system is set up, including those 6-year programs where students can go right through from high school into these job providing trades. Also, the ability for students to have more access to those college level classes within high school. Those are big deals. I'm also working on trying to come up with a compromise. I have a bill that comes up with a compromise to try to regulate vacation rentals in the state, because that's been a mess depending on which part of the state it is.
Oh, we've talked about that a lot.
And that can get that can get pretty hairy. So we'll see how that goes.
You're heading up to Tallahassee soon.
I am heading up this weekend.
We've been talking with Republican State Senator Manny Diaz Jr. of District 36. Again, the session starts January 14th. Senator, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And that is Sundial for this Wednesday, January 8th. We've had the pleasure of been doing the program today from the Miami Herald studios here in Doral today. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandro Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Well, coming up tomorrow on Sundial, we're dedicating an entire show to the 10th anniversary of the Haiti earthquake. We've assembled a panel conversation with reporters Nadege Green, Tim Padgett, and Jacqueline Charles to discuss the recovery effort following the earthquake, and we'll understand why the country continues to struggle politically and economically 10 years later. And we want to hear from you. Where were you when you heard about the earthquake? Did you have family in Haiti? Share your story with us. Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org, and we'll include excerpts as part of the program. That, again, coming up tomorrow. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Find us online, WLRN.org. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.